What time should I go to?
7:30.
7:30, yeah. Okay. My name is Eddie, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Eddie.
Thank you, Mark, for asking me to speak. And thanks for welcoming me to your meeting. I know this is a big book meeting, so I've selected a passage to discuss, but before I get into the reading, I think it's important to give some background about my story, my disease, what it was like, and how I got here. And I'll pick up the reading that I selected. I first read this passage, which is going to be pages 61 to 63, certain passages. I first read it when I was on the Long Island Railroad, and I had, I don't know, maybe 30 days sober, and it changed my life. So my sobriety date is April 28th, 2014. AA has saved my life, changed my life, given me a life that I never thought I'd have, and it removed the obsession to drink from me, which is something that I didn't know about when I first came in. This is the meeting. Come on in. I grew up in Long Island, I sort of had a normal upbringing, had some problems with binge drinking, some problems with the law, some red flags, I think. You know, totaled my car in a blackout in Southold, and I was involved in a fight when I was 17, and I was looking at serious jail time. But none of those consequences really had an impact on me in terms of my drinking. I just thought I had to get my. Are we clean or can we curse? Get my shit together. That's a soft one.
Yeah.
Get my crap together. I thought I just needed to get it together and maybe learn how to drink like a gentleman, you know, have a glass of wine before work. That's a prelude to what happened. Have a glass of wine after work like my friends and just be normal. I wanted that really badly. My drinking, I'll just fast forward to like when it got bad. My drinking got really bad when I first went to law school. At the end of college, I went to college in SUNY Buffalo, having basically flunked out of my first school, and then I went to SUNY Buffalo, and then I started isolating drinking and isolating smoking marijuana by myself. And I was on probation at the time for the previously mentioned DWI and fight. I just liked to be alone in my room drinking where nobody could bother me. And that was me when I was, you know, under 21. I guess I was like 19, 20 in college. And then when I got to law school, I was 21. And I got off probation at the same time. So I no longer had to pee in a cup. And like my addiction and alcoholism spiraled like wildly out of control, incredibly fast. And I could say that now, sitting here at this table. But back then, I think, you know, it was harder to really consider the severity of the situation when I was in it. Suffice it to say, it was bad. I could talk about the things I did, like hiding bottles, you know, having to go through different garbage cans in Brooklyn Heights to try to like fill up this garbage can and that garbage can with bottles, because I didn't want people to see the bottles stacking up, or opening a beer can really quietly at like 7 a.m. so that my roommates didn't hear me, not going to class, lying to everybody all the time about where I was and what I was doing. I was in law school and just basically drinking it all away, and living a double life. On the outside, I'm a good kid, you know, I'm going to law school, leave me alone. And all I really wanted to do and all I really did was drink, eat like crazy, and smoke a ton of weed. And that was the things I did. The feelings, though, were much, much worse than the things. The feelings are always worse than the things for me. And they're in sobriety, the feelings are better than the things. But back then, the feelings were really bad. I was so anxious all the time, like so anxious. Like now people talk about anxiety, mental health. Like, I don't know, back then I didn't really have vocabulary for it, but like I was really suffering, wildly wound up and so fearful of everything. Fearful of the future. I didn't want to grow up. I didn't want to have to get a job. I didn't want to do taxes. I don't know. And fearful that I was never going to be good enough. I was never going to really make it. You know, the law thing's probably not going to work out. Also, like, I don't really know what I want to do. Who am I? Like, all I want to do is really just get messed up, watch Netflix, chill, maybe write a memoir. This is kind of like the weird thing. It's like, when I was, like, in it, I would, like, romanticize it. And it's like, yeah, I'm going to write a memoir about this when I'm, like, in my 30s. And I'll be, like, maybe write a screenplay and become famous. And, like, this is all just, like, a sexy, cool, like, prelude to, like, my second act, which is going to be, like, I'm a cool artist. That's really what I am. While I'm, like, blacking out in a movie theater by myself with a bag of beer at, like, 2 p.m. It was a sad existence. Much sadder now from pulling back. But it was pretty tragic. And I was hopeless. I didn't think that there was a way out. Okay? I just thought that, you know, this was me. This is what I had become. You know, maybe one day I could change it. I could change it around. But like in the meantime, I can't look in the mirror. You know, I looked like crap. Like, I'll just be honest. Like, I remember when I first came into the rooms, I remember I had a friend that would tell me, like, dude, like you were like grayish yellow. I had like a severe overeating problem. I was like 200 pounds, 5'7", small frame, and bloated. And I really looked every pound of it. And come on in. And
just looking for my niece.
Oh, okay.
She said she was coming here.
Check the bathroom.
Mary Brown.
Check the bathroom.
Thank you.
Sorry. This disease is a real SOB. Anyway, I looked like crap. I felt like crap. And there wasn't really a way out. And what happened was I had to go to an AA meeting in order to be admitted to the New York State Bar to become a practicing attorney because I had the criminal stuff on my record, and they knew that, and it was drinking related. So they're like, you have to go to this AA meeting and sign your name on a sheet. And I like procrastinated for a long time, broke up with my girlfriend who I was living with at the time, and like sort of like things came to a head, and I just went to that meeting. I'll never forget it. I expected to see like people that were like gritting their teeth and sort of like upset that they couldn't drink anymore.
I'm sorry.
No worries.
Does she have like a reddish?
Yes, reddish hair.
She was here. She was here, but then she left.
Is this her stuff?
Yes.
Probably, yeah.
So I went to my first AA meeting, pretty broken, coming off of like a heartbreak, and I said, my name's Eddie, and I had a really bad day, and I thought I was going to hear like all these old people that couldn't drink anymore and were sort of pissed off that they couldn't drink, and what I heard was laughter and lightness, and I heard somebody say that they had the obsession removed from them and that they no longer wanted to drink. And that was like a ding moment for me, because like I did not think that was a thing. To no longer have the desire to drink, that was very attractive to me. No worries. And everything good? We'll see.
We'll see.
Where was I?
It's like you felt that the first time you ever heard that the obsession.
Oh yeah, to not want to drink. That was a beautiful thing. So I ended up talking to a guy at that meeting, and he became my. I asked him to be my sponsor, and I was sort of reading the stuff. And sort of trying to figure it out, reading the book, but not really wanting to do the steps on the wall. I was suffering in the rooms. I would go out every 10 days, 20 days, I would drink or use. That went on for like 9 months. And I would come back, put my hand up, Eddie, day one, you guys would clap. And I would just start all over again. And it was terrible. It was like I was in Groundhog's Day, and I was like in the meat grinder, but I was like in AA. And then one day I was going to meetings, though, and I'd always come back, and I'd always say, the next day after I drank, I'd always come back, put my hand up. And I'd give my day count, because my sponsor said to do that. And I would tell him, I'd be like, listen, I drank, or I did whatever drug I did. And he'd say, thank you for your honesty, go to a meeting, share about it, and I did. And then I think at some point in 2014, I was on the Long Island Railroad coming home from work, and I always drank on the train. That was like my thing. I was like, I would get a beer in Penn Station. I would already be drunk, frankly, but I would get like a beer at Penn Station, and I would crack that bad boy open on the train, and it was like, I have made it, sort of thing. Like, oh, I'm a businessman drinking, even though I was a complete mess and not a businessman. But that was like my thing. I'm like a dignified commuter drinking beer on the Long Island Railroad, like a real grown-up. But I couldn't, this time I didn't drink, didn't have my beer, but I really wanted to. So I reached inside my bag. Instead of a beer, I pulled out this book, which they were telling me to read, and I wasn't, because it sounded like old-timey English that I couldn't really understand. I remember asking my sponsor, I was like, is there like a version where they write it more like in today's language? Because this stuff doesn't make any sense to me. And like, they don't talk about drinking. Like, this is not going to solve my problem. Like, I don't understand this. And I remember somebody at a meeting said, my sponsor always tells me to go to read pages 62 and 63. And I'm like, oh, man, I'm on the railroad. I really wanted a drink. I'm like, all right, let me go to page 62. And that first paragraph right there, it hit me like a ton of bricks. It says, selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity, we step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us, seemingly without provocation, but we invariably find that at some time in the past, we made decisions based on self, which later placed us in a position to be hurt. And then I read this line, and this gave me goosebumps. So our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. They arise out of ourselves, and the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. The reason why this hit me in the face when I was reading it is because I grew up as like a very raised as like a very like DIY, do it yourself, self-made. Like I could always get myself out of any jam. I would be able, I was the kind of guy, like in law school, like that first semester where I was drinking around the clock, like I ended up cramming like 3 days before finals and like getting like a 3.8. Like I was like, I can do like anything. I considered myself like on self-will and like coffee and like I could just, I can get myself out of every jam. And it was always like that, like with everything I did my whole life. Except for this thing. That sort of thing didn't work with addiction. But I was trying to make it work. And I was sort of stiff-arming the program a little bit because I didn't like the idea of a cop-out. Like when people talk about the disease of alcoholism, I would like roll my eyes like, oh, disease, like what a cop-out. Like I didn't catch this like I catch a cold. Like nobody putting a gun to my head and making me drink. Like I'm doing this. Like I wanted a way to fix myself from the inside. And I viewed the program of recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous as like a soft person's way of getting better. Like, oh, like this is like where people go and, you know, they sort of like, they make excuses for themselves. That's what I thought this was. But then when I read this, it says, our troubles are of our own making. They arise out of ourselves. And that was like the first time I had read this in the book. And it's talking about selfishness, self-centeredness. It's talking about that we are the root of our addiction. And that spoke to me deeply because that is sort of what I felt was the case. And as I read on and as I went to more meetings and listened, I learned that Alcoholics Anonymous is the ultimate self-accountability program. It is not the coward's way out. It is not the soft way out. It's the exact opposite. It's through this program, we are required to face all of our problems head on, all of our fears head on. We're no longer allowed to run from anything. Running was drinking. Running was using. I wasn't allowed to do that anymore, and I had to face the music. Specifically, that first paragraph, selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. At that time, like I was wildly depressed. I was disillusioned. I was like floating in the ocean without like a paddle, and I was just like I didn't know who I was, where I was going. I didn't know the meaning of anything. But I didn't think I was a selfish person. I certainly didn't think I was self-centered. In fact, I didn't think much of myself at all. You know, when I thought of people that are self-centered or people with ego, I would think of like the dudes at the gym that were like taking selfies with the cutoffs and like posting on Instagram, like stuff like that. And I'm like, I'm just a humble guy, man. I'm not self-centered at all. But then I heard someone share in a meeting, I'm not much, but I'm all I think about. I was like, oh. And then I heard someone say, like, talk about the piece of shit at the center of the universe. And I'm like, huh. Here I am, like, wildly depressed, anxious, and fearful, but it's all about me. And, like, that was, like, a light bulb moment where I was like, maybe I am self-centered in a way that I never considered before. Like, I am centering on myself. And that's sort of, that was a turning point in my recovery because it was the first time that I think I had what came to be a shift in perspective. I realized that my fears and my worries were incredibly centered on my own self. I wasn't really all that concerned about helping other people. I didn't think I could be much help of anybody, to be honest. And I thought that if you were in my position, you'd feel the way I felt too. If you went through what I went through, you probably wouldn't be able to handle this as well as I'm handling it. And it was a completely unrealistic perspective on life that I now recognize was driven by my addiction, because that sort of thinking keeps you drinking. Like, that sort of, like, I now see my addiction, my alcoholism, as, like, driving the way that I think. Like, that sort of selfishness, self-centered, self-pity, woe is me, you wouldn't get it. Trust me, you don't get it. You couldn't do this. You couldn't sit where I'm sitting if you went through. Like, that sort of thinking is my disease speaking to me in my own voice. And it is only so that I keep drinking. Like, that is... And in order to break from that thinking, I had to take on and adopt a set of principles and perspectives that I never considered before. And I had to open my mind and sort of give in and let go. You know, the last paragraph of... The last sentence of that paragraph, it says, we invariably find that at some point in the past, we made decisions based on self, which later placed us in a position to be hurt. That's such a powerful line, because you ever notice that in the book, when they're talking about, you know, when they're conveying, like, the message of recovery, they rarely speak in terms of this person hurt me, or like this thing happened to me and therefore I became hurt or afraid or whatever. To phrase it the way they phrase it, placed us in a position to be hurt, suggests that I can think about any situation differently and I can be positioned where I'm less likely to be hurt, basically. Or maybe I can be hurt, but I won't be like wildly devastated, my world would be rocked, like how I used to feel. Like, maybe I can feel feelings like a well-adjusted member of society, and I can be hurt, and I can process them without drinking or drugging, and I can get through it. And that's a perspective thing. It's you know, the following like page and a half all talks about the director, right? This is the director passage. Director of the play trying to arrange the actors and the scenery in a way that would suit the director best. And the show would be a real hit if only the props would stay in place and the actors said their lines and everybody did what they were supposed to do. My life would be great. That was me. Like, when I say, like, I was like a real do-it-yourself guy, like, I thought that I can, they talk about, I could wrest satisfaction out of this life with hard work. Like, I can get my shit together. I can do it. This is like me. Eddie can do it because he's always done it in the past. And what this passage, you know, 62 to 63, and the principles of AA. And look, I'm not. I just want to like pause here for a second, because I got this tape recorder here, and I'm talking to you guys on like a book, and like I can feel like a lecturer or like an AA novelist. Like I'm not a professor. I really went through a lot of pain, and I live this shit. Like, this is not a theory in this book. It's not a philosophy necessarily. It's an action. Recovery is an action word. It's not like so. I don't mean to like pontificate, but this is the sort of attitudinal change that I went through and that I continue to strive for that keeps me sober and happy one day at a time. Anyway, I just want to also skip forward. So basically, this talks about selfishness, self-centeredness. I had to let go, and basically I had to let God, higher power, whatever that is to anybody, I came to understand that to be, I had to just give my life and my will over to something greater than me. And I didn't want to do it. I thought it was silly. I never believed in God. I really pushed back at it until I absolutely couldn't anymore. I pushed back on it until I wanted to get sober more than I wanted to be correct about anything, really. I just wanted to get sober, and I knew that other people seemed happy and they were sober, so I just tried the whole higher power thing, and my life completely changed. In that first year, I experienced a pink cloud that lasted like till now, basically. I never in my wildest dreams thought that in the ensuing 9 years from sitting on that, or 10 years, whenever that was, sitting on the train reading this passage to now, like what my life would have become. It's pretty insane. The craziest part of all is that I don't have a desire to drink. Like, that is nuts. Or use. And I could really do anything without feeling like I need to drink. I can go to weddings and dance like an idiot, which I've done sober. I've gone on dates sober. And I've dated sober, and I got married sober. I danced at my own wedding sober. I had a child sober. I had people die in my life that I'm very close to, that I was very close to, sober. And I felt all the feelings, man. I felt all of them, thank God. When my grandpa died, I was on vacation. I was so close to him. And I never cried, really, when anybody died. Grandpa, like my other grandpa on my other side, grandma's on either side, never really cried. When my grandpa died, I was on vacation in Costa Rica with my now wife. And I cried like a baby for like 2 days, man. I was like just processed emotions like I never processed them before. And it, thank God. Thank God that like the programs allowed me to be able to process my emotions and cry, get through stuff, be vulnerable, share. If I'm going through something, I could share it with somebody now instead of holding it all in. I have a beautiful life now. I have a wife. I have an 11-month-old son who's kept me awake for the last 11 months. I have another one on the way. I have a house, 2 cars. I have a job I could show up for and not call out sick, even though like I'm just anxious and can't get out of bed, which is what I used to be, or I was just hungover, or I just really needed to get effed up. I don't have to do that anymore. I don't have to lie to anybody. I rarely lie, and when I do lie, I tell somebody about it. And I often come clean. And what I do on a daily basis to keep that going is I try to reach out to newcomers. I just picked up a new sponsee, thank God. I pray in the morning. I do an inventory at night and I send it to someone. I do a gratitude list. I go to page 63, like I just read, and I remember, I read the third step prayer, and I remember what it was like. That's like my big thing. Like, I'll forget, everybody that goes out, and I know that if I ever go out, it's because I'm going to forget, because my life is so good. I have the kid, I have the job, I have the car, I have everything's great. Like, I don't really need to go to another meeting. Like, I don't need to pray, or I could just sort of slack off. And I will start forgetting, you know, basically what I need to do to stay sober. I'll start forgetting that I have a deadly, incurable disease and that what I get is a daily reprieve from my disease one day at a time. I'll forget that. I'll think that I'm cured, which I'm not. So I try to remember, like, what it was like that pit in the stomach, crappy feeling when you're in active addiction, bless you. And then I'll go to page 86, and it says, when we retire at night, we constructively review our day. And this is sort of like the inventory, which I do, but I like to flip it. So it says, were we kind and loving toward all? Like when I pray in the morning too, I use that. I use this passage. So I pray that I can be kind and loving toward all as I go throughout the day. It says, were we thinking of ourselves most of the time? I pray to God to allow me to not think of myself most of the time and instead try to think of what I could do for others, of what I could pack into the stream of life. Carefully about what that will mean for the day. Like, what does that even look like? Because, like, theoretically, that sounds great. Yeah, pack into a stream of life. Cool. Okay, but, like, I try to think practically, like, okay, I have a meeting or I have work, whatever it is. Like, what does packing it into the stream of life look like? And for me, that looks like doing the best I can at work, staying in the moment, being nice to people, not being a jerk to people, asking people how they're doing. Basically carrying the message of AA in all my affairs. You know, not like proselytizing, but like practicing the principles of AA in all my affairs, really, is more accurate. Trying to be like a little bit of light where there's darkness. In that page 62-63 passage, it says like the director of the play, he's really a creator of confusion, not harmony. And I guess what recovery has taught me is, like, if I have any chance to stay sober, if I have any real shot at being happy, which at the end of the day is what I really want, frankly, is that I need to try to be a producer of harmony and not confusion. And I can't do that left my own devices. I just can't. I know if I think I can, I'll end up back on the train and on Long Island Railroad or whatever train, drinking my life away and hiding it from everybody. Cause that's what my addiction looks like. I don't have to feel that way anymore. I don't have to drink. I don't have to use. It's incredible. I owe it all to AA, and I just try to keep it seriously one day at a time. Just focus on today, go to sleep tonight, and start all over again tomorrow, because I'm a worrier and I have a disease of worry. My anxiety is built from worrying about tomorrow and work and what's going to happen and this is not going to work out, and I'll just drive myself crazy and, it's not realistic, really. Like, that sort of thinking is truly delusional. Like they say, driven by 100 forms of fear and delusion. Like, I will delude myself into thinking that it's really not going to be okay, when really it is, as long as I have a higher power in my life and I don't keep secrets and I share with people and I try to be honest. So that's my message, and thanks for letting me carry it today.